Friends, before we start today's show, I want to tell you about an incredible new Twin Peaks book that is coming out from Fayetteville Mafia Press, the publisher that brought us The Women of Lynch and Conversations with Mark Frost. This new book is written by my friend, the incredible Courtney Stallings. The name of the book is called Laura's Ghost, Women Speak About Twin Peaks. In this new book, Courtney and her talented writers explore Laura Palmer's legacy through the perspectives of women in the fan community and women involved in the show. These writers include actor Cheryl Lee, who examines the challenges of playing Laura Palmer. Filmmaker Jennifer Lynch discusses writing Laura's backstory in The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. Grace Zabriskie argues about the complicity of Sarah Palmer, Laura's mother. And Sabrina Sutherland, executive producer of Twin Peaks, talks about Laura's legacy, plus many more essays. In Laura's Ghost, women in the Twin Peaks fan community share their powerful and heart-wrenching stories of survival and what Laura Palmer means to them. This book is a reckoning in which women speak about trauma, mischief, humor, sexuality, strength, weakness, wickedness, and survival. Go out to BlueRoseMag.com and pre-order this book now. But that's not all, because you can listen to a conversation with Courtney and Cheryl Lee in episode 184 of the Red Room Podcast, which you can find on your preferred podcast player. So go subscribe and listen to the Red Room Podcast. But now, on to our show. Welcome to episode 8 of the In Our House Now podcast, an inquiry into Twin Peaks The Return. I'm one of your hosts, Josh J.B. Minton, and I'm joined by my co-host and esteemed colleague, Mr. John Thorne. John, welcome again.
Hey, Josh. Great to talk to you as always.
So today is going to be very special, I think. we promise no answers.
Right.
In this podcast. But lots of questions. Can you introduce our theme for this episode?
Yeah, today we're going to be talking about the enigmatic Philip Jeffries, who may not really exist anymore. And you know what just occurred to me? This was completely accidental. This is episode 8 of our podcast, and it has to do with Jeffries, who is associated with the number 8, and that was totally happenstance,
but not random, I feel.
I think David Lynch would subscribe to the idea that, you know, these things are not random, that numbers have meaning, and we didn't plan this, though. I just noticed it right now. So anyway, episode 8, Philip Jeffries.
it was meant to be.
Right.
Whenever we're talking about Twin Peaks and we think about how something was written in the moment where it means one thing and then later it's retrofitted to mean something else for a number of reasons. Can we talk about that a little bit before we get into Jeffries?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a truth that dates back to the earliest times of Twin Peaks, is that things were being developed in the story. Essentially in the moment. A great example, of course, is the European ending to the pilot, which was written to tag on to the end and make it a so-called self-contained storyline for European release. And I don't think anyone thought anything would come of that extra 15 minutes, but when the series got picked up, they incorporated that into the dream of Dale Cooper. And so once that happened, it became an established part of the narrative. And then the story kind of had to fit around that. And, it was in some ways, it wasn't intended to be what it ended up being. And I think that's true as you go through and you get into Fire Walk With Me and you get the Owl Cave Ring. I think the Owl Cave Ring, when it was originally scripted in Fire Walk With Me, was going to mean one thing, and then Lynch in the editing process is sort of reconfiguring Fire Walk With Me to be its own standalone work, kind of saw it perhaps as something else, or it took on new meaning when it came into The Return. So those are two examples, and I think a third example is Philip Jeffries, that for various reasons may have been intended to be one thing and became maybe something else in the return.
Yeah, and I think tightly coupled with Philip Jeffries is this concept of Judy as well. So we'll definitely be talking about Judy, but more in relation to Philip, right?
Yeah, but Judy's a great example. Yeah, I think Judy was intended to be one thing, was changed to something else again, as Lynch and then Frost progressed through this storyline. So,
you know, before we jump in, there's the logistical reasons as to why things were changed. So one of the first things we'll talk about is David Bowie. You know, his death was, it actually rocked many, many people around the world, but, you know, Twin Peaks in particular, right?
Absolutely. And I think most fans know this, that the word is that David Bowie was intended to be in the show to reprise the role of Philip Jeffries that he performed in Fire Walk With Me. And I think Lynch and Frost, you know, expected that he would be in it. And I think Bowie, before he passed away, was aware that this was coming and would do it again. But then, you know, obviously, unfortunately, he died. And so because of that, the character of Philip Jeffries sort of had to be reimagined. And I think that introduced some ambiguity that may or may not have been intended by Frost. Lynch just embraced it. That is an unexpected event that may have shifted the narrative a little bit. We're going to explore that in this podcast.
So that's, you know, the logistical reason as to why these things were done and put up eventually to what we saw on the screen. Then there's the fan side of it, where, as you know, analysts and appreciators of Twin Peaks, we have to make sense of that somehow. So, you know, understanding the logistical is one thing, and then kind of figuring out what it means for us is a totally different thing.
Okay, well, so I guess I was going to, you know, just get into what started me down this path, if you don't mind. You know, I've been writing about The Return. I'm moving my way slowly through it. And I think I got to part 13, where Ray is been shot by Mr. C, and they're talking about Philip Jeffries. And, I was trying to unwrap, you know, who Philip Jeffries is and what his role is in the story. And, he appears a few times in The Return, and we know that the initial encounter with Jeffries, and I say encounter, is on the telephone with Mr. C in part two. And it turns out that in all likelihood, Mr. C is not talking to Philip Jeffries, that he realizes that this is not, or at least, you know, it's not Jeffries. It's an imposter, I guess, is the best way to phrase it. And so then the question starts to arise is, you know, how much of what Jeffries' role and appearances in the whole story has been, quote unquote, the real Jeffries or the imposter Jeffries? And that's really kind of where I was like, you know, this is confusing and it's hard to unwrap. You know, I have to go to this great book, Conversations with Mark Frost by David Bushman. And it was there that, Frost talks about how perhaps the Philip Jeffries character was intended to be one thing initially, and then it changed. And so on page 270 of this Conversation with Mark Frost, Frost says, "It all turned on David Bowie's availability. He was going to do the show he wanted to, but sadly it didn't happen. And so Lynch was left with a choice about how to film or dramatize those scenes we'd written without access to an actor. We discussed it a lot, trying to find a way that would serve that purpose." And so they're talking about how, you know, it kind of altered a little bit, which we went over. And then Bushman asks Mark Frost about that conversation I just mentioned, that first Philip Jeffries quote unquote appearance in the storyline. And this is fascinating because Frost is pretty explicit here. He says it was someone pretending to be Philip Jeffries. But more than that, Frost tells us why. to gain access to more information about someone else's location. And then Frost says, I'll leave you to guess who it might be. And I assume what he's saying is there, I'll leave you to guess who the imposter might be. And so that got me going. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, who is the imposter and what is his role, the imposter's role, and how much of the imposter is a presence versus what we might assume would be the real Philip Jeffries. So we can talk about it. I have a theory on who I think the imposter is. I think it's a pretty good one. And I would say that because we have explicitly from Frost that there is an imposter, the question becomes, is how much is Philip Jeffries really there? And I might venture a guess to say that we may only really see Philip, quote unquote, the Philip Jeffries who's not really there anymore, only one time in the narrative, which I know is perhaps a little, a little bit radical, but we talk about that too.
Yeah. So let's start with that scene and figure out, you know, from that, what Mark said, what's happened at that moment when Mr. C is talking to who he thinks is Philip Jeffries. So he's already discovered that Ray was arrested and is now being processed into prison in South Dakota. He obviously has already taken his revenge on Daria, and now he's being confronted by someone he thinks is Jeffries, but it might not be. And now if they're trying to find out the location of someone, would you say that that's Ray?
No, I think so. I think that the voice is pretty explicit. The voice says, you're going back in and I will be with Bob again. Now, you know, I will be with Bob again is our crucial clue. Who would be with Bob again? There are a few candidates who that might be. The first is Leland Palmer. Could potentially be Leland Palmer because he was with Bob at one point. And so that, you know, could be Leland who's saying, you're going back in and I'll be with Bob again. I don't think it's Leland for lots of reasons. I think Leland had somewhat redeemed himself in the original series. I think he is a haunted soul from what we see in The Return, that he has no desire to be with Bob again at all, and he's still trying to atone for the terrible sins that he committed. And nor do I think Leland would have the savvy, you know, prowess to find a way to manipulate and maneuver Mr. C and Ray and these various other characters. So I don't think it's Leland. The other option would be the Arm, also known as the little man. So we know from Firewalk with Me that the Arm was in league with Bob, and they were working together, and they were amassing Garmon Bozia, and I think the little man's role was that he kind of would impose the Owl Cave ring on someone, which would mark a victim, and then that would cause Bob to target that person. So it could be the Arm, but you know, from what we see in The Return, the Arm has kind of evolved into this unusual creature, sort of a tree, and he's a good candidate, but he seems to be, or it seems to be, I think is a better pronoun to use, it seems to be kind of beyond this this realm now, and not involved in the everyday goings on of the real world. So the third candidate, whom I think is probably the correct identity of the imposter, is Mike. Mike, the inhabiting spirit of Philip Gerard. It was Mike from the original show who was in pursuit of Bob. It was Mike who wanted to, as he said explicitly, wanted to stop Bob. That was sort of his mission. And it's Mike in Firewalk with Me who reprimands Bob, who reunites with the Arm, and takes what little pain and sorrow Bob has gotten from Leland and takes it away. And he basically reprimands Bob in that in that instance. So I think Mike is a great candidate. Now, Mike technically doesn't appear at all in the return, so I would argue he's sort of a character operating off in the margins. But still, he has a backstory which fits with this idea that he would want to, once again, as he has done, it seems repetitively through the narrative, track down and get Bob. And it makes sense when he says, I will be with Bob again, because Bob was his familiar. Bob was a spirit that, a spirit force that was in league with Mike for some time before Mike became essentially good. He saw the face of God. So anyway, that's my theory on Mike. We can talk about why there's more evidence to support Mike. But once you start thinking about the idea that there is an imposter, whether it's Mike or a different identity, you know, it could be many potentially other characters, or, you know, we could go through a list, but I won't bother with that right now. But once you establish that there's an imposter, then the question becomes, again, how much of what we think is Philip Jeffries are the actions of this imposter that seems to be working against Mr. C? And that's something else I wanted to explore. And of course, it leads into who or what is Philip Jeffries.
Yeah, I think that's really important. So this concept of an imposter, you know, what if we never see the real Philip Jeffries? You know, what if we always have to see the mask of whatever the agency is behind Philip Jeffries? And I just think it's interesting that we've got, you know, Philip Gerard and Philip Jeffries. Those are very similar names, just in the alliteration and in the way that they're structured. And perhaps both of those entities are manifestations of the same agency. So it's always going to be an imposter.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I agree. It's striking that their names are so similar. It's also striking that, you know, the character of, let's just say, the one-armed man, for a generic term, is only credited or defined as the character Philip Gerard in the story. He's never credited as Mike. He's not called the one-armed man. Again, he doesn't need to be called that. But he's Philip Gerard. But we know there was this character who was Mike, who was, you know, explicitly connected with Philip Gerard. And he even says, I stay close to this vessel, inhabiting it from time to time. These are lines of dialogue from the original series, establishing the fact that Mike was never far from Philip Gerard. Now, whether or not, you know, Lynch and Frost even remembered that, we don't know. Although it's interesting that Frost, you know, is saying, There is this other person pretending to be Philip Jeffries. Really, we can't ignore that Philip Jeffries and Philip Gerard are almost the same name.
Right. You know, I think of the scene in The Matrix when the agent like inhabits the character of anyone that's around Neo. You know what I mean? Like you could just kind of see him come forward inside of those characters. And perhaps Philip Gerard in the original Twin Peaks was that character that he inhabited, that spirit or that agency, you know, manifested itself inside of. And Philip Gerard is that for the Red Room. I mean, I'm thinking of the scenes in particular where we can see Philip Gerard waving to Dougie Jones through this kind of, you know, portal in between the Red Room and what's happening to Cooper as he's Dougie Jones. Like he obviously can't manifest inside of, you know, a character within the Dougie Jones experience, but he can still engage with them. You know what I mean? From his Philip Gerard space.
Absolutely. And I think that's important because you have, let's say Philip Gerard, and that Philip Gerard is occasionally inhabited or transforms into this other personality, which is Mike. Either way, neither character seems to be able to, from what we see of Philip Gerard, seems to be able to manifest in the real world, to actually, you know, come about. They seem to be communicating outside of that realm and trying to get various agents of their own to do the work they need. Perhaps more so with what I would call the imposter Jeffrey's Mike. He seems to be very deliberate about what he's trying to do, which is to stop Mr. C and get Bob back. The Gerard version seems to be a little more confused I'm trying to think of the right word, maybe a weaker character, in that he's giving advice, don't die, you know, and wake up, and he's trying his best, but he doesn't seem to be able to take any more precise control out in the real world. He's just trying to communicate. And so I think, you know, there is a difference there between the way Gerard behaves and what he thinks his capabilities are, and the way Mike, if there is a Mike. And again, I want to emphasize, I realize that if there is a Mike, we never see him, and that he is entirely outside the margins of the story.
Like Judy, by the way, right?
Yes, there's a number of characters who arguably could be just completely outside the margins of the story. And, I don't want to get too far off on a tangent here, and you know how I do that. But I'm thinking a lot about Diane, and I've been writing about Diane. I just tweeted something out about Diane, about her saying, I'm not me. I think Diane, that there's a Diane personality that's outside of the margins, perhaps, who we have to kind of try to apprehend in a way by seeing the various versions of her in the story. That's just an example. And so Mike is perhaps, you know, someone we don't actually see, but is still a presence.
So that's the first time that Philip Jeffries makes an appearance in The Return, I believe. And that's part two that you're talking about there.
Right. Well, and again, an entity that's calling itself Philip Jeffries. And I think we're all been in this case as we watch Twin Peaks. Certainly the first time we assume it is Philip Jeffries. And then of course it says, you know, that essentially says that it's not. And Mr. C is somewhat taken aback by the fact that in that moment he's been tricked. He thought it was Jeffries and it's not. And then you have to ask the question, have all the previous times that Mr. C has talked with this entity he assumed was Philip Jeffries, was it Jeffries or was it always the imposter? And I would venture that it was probably always the imposter. And it was only here at the cusp of the time where the time that was coming where Mr. C knew he might get drawn back in, that the imposter revealed itself. Perhaps the imposter believed it was, holding all the cards, so to speak. You know, that there was, you know, he had a plan; it was going to work. There was no way out, and he's basically telling, you know, Mr. C, you're going back in. But before that, perhaps I think quite likely, Mr. C was talking to the imposter and didn't realize it. Thought he was talking to Philip Jeffries.
I agree. I like to think of the purpose, so the mechanism of what, you know, Jeffries is trying to do here is in line with getting the double back into the Red Room so that it can be balanced out, you know, after the 25 years of dream time or whatever that is. Whatever that mechanism is to pull the darkness back into balance, I think that whatever's on the phone here represents that force.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it gets a little confusing. And I think we should say right up front here that I'm not sure Lynch and Frost necessarily have it all worked out themselves for various reasons. I think one reason might be, you know, Lynch is just less interested in all the mechanics of that backstory. And so he, you know, it doesn't matter to him as much. And Frost, perhaps because the Mike character, if you, again, we want to say it's Mike, but even if we don't get that explicit, the whole idea of what Bob and Mike and these inhabiting spirits that were kind of presented to us in the original Twin Peaks, they really wasn't fully worked out there either. I don't think they could tell you, especially when Firewall Comique rolls around and it confuses it even more, you know, what is going on there. So because of that, is this entity just trying to get Bob back? There seems to be some evidence that it cares more about Bob than it really cares about the fate of Dale Cooper. Just, I want to get Bob back. Or, you know, is there, as you say, perhaps a larger scheme in place that it's just saying it's trying to restore the balance, it's trying to help Cooper. I my first inclination would be that it doesn't really care about Cooper. It cares about just getting Bob back. But, you know, you can come at it from different angles, and there's evidence to support either interpretation.
So I think a good analogy of what that represents is a white blood cell. So a white blood cell in your body could attack healthy cells if it believes that it's a disease. You know what I mean? If there's a corruption within that cell's ability to determine what is friendly and what is not, it will attack anything, which is, you know, essentially what diseases like immunodeficiency do, right? And so, you know, they don't think, it's not a higher function of thinking, which I would ascribe to more something like the fireman, who's concerned with, you know, the dreamer's soul, or the person's soul, the gold seed, obviously. But where this whatever's talking on the phone here just wants to get the darkness back in balance, I feel like.
Yeah, I think, yeah, and again, it gets complicated and confusing, because if it's Mike, again, I'm going to maintain that it is, you know, Mike, you know, says, I saw the face of God and I took the arm off. And you get the impression that he's trying to do good. But Mike never really seems to really do anything good. He doesn't do anything bad either, necessarily. He seems to be, again, as you say, or this imposter, or whatever we want to say this force is, I think its motivation is get Bob. And get Bob back in again, which again seems to me to be just what Mike would do.
Yes, I agree. I think we're fine. I think we can move on with this. But man, we could just go on and on about Batman and Blade and all kinds of other characters that are similar to this. But I think it's important we establish that something related to Philip Jeffries is connected to this force of bringing balance back, or getting Bob back. Let's just call it that. And it's established very early on in the return.
Yeah. Yes, and so part of its scheme has been to get various real-world agents to do its, you know, bidding, or to, you know, do its assign these real-world agents, you know, certain missions. And two of those real-world agents were Array and Daria, and their mission was to kill Mr. C. They had to shoot Mr. C because they wanted to get Bob out of it, or, you know, the imposter wanted to retrieve Bob. And so their mission is to, I think Ray says, we got to hit him tonight. You know, he tells Daria, I'm in jail. You've got to do it. And of course, Mr. C's always a couple of steps ahead. And so Ray and Daria fail, certainly Daria fails at her mission. But these are agents in the employ of the imposter. And so I would argue, and we're going to get, I think we're ready to get into this, that the plan the imposter has set in place with Ray is just one of many he may have set in place. And there's evidence that this is happened before, that the imposter tried to do this in the past. I think you were heading toward what the second Philip Jeffries mention in the narrative is after this Mr. C encounter, and that's from Albert in part 4, where Albert tells Gordon Cole that he had been in contact with Philip Jeffries years ago. And that Philip Jeffries had asked for the name of, I think it's the way he phrases it, is, you know, their man in Colombia. And then a week later, or a number of days later, that man ended up, or that agent ended up dead. And this startles Cole when Albert tells Cole this, because Cole didn't know anything about it. And Cole is kind of stunned to even hear the name Philip Jeffries in this moment. You know, Jeffries, you know, why are you talking about, you know, why did he contact, and did he mention Cooper? And I forget the dialogue, but you know the scene. And this is where, on a first watch, we're we're led to believe that Albert's been in touch with Philip Jeffries, you know, and this must be Philip Jeffries. He's saying it's Philip Jeffries. And, you know, we all know Philip Jeffries is this strange character from Fire Walk With Me. Upon thinking about it some more and looking at what's going on in this backstory that Mr. C is starting to unravel in part two, I would posit that Albert talked to the imposter too, that it was the imposter that contacted Albert in an effort to get, you know, and again, this was years before Ray, to find someone who could take out Mr. C, who was active in South America. And we know this, he's bouncing around South America, and there's a lot of evidence in the story to show that he's been in different countries in South America. And so it's no surprise he might be in Colombia, or there may be someone in Colombia who could move around South America somewhat easily. And I think that this is what was going on there, that Albert was kind of duped as well, thinking he was talking to Jeffries, because Jeffries, or the imposter, was trying to get someone to kill Mr. C way back when, and it failed, of course, because Mr. C is always a couple of steps ahead, and whoever that was, it was going to under the employ of the imposter Jeffries, was killed by Mr. C, probably. That's why he ended up dead.
Let's just say in a normal situation where Bob is not present, an agency like Philip Jeffries could easily bring things back into balance by doing just what you just said. So I'm sending people out. They're going to take care of this. It's not a problem. This is how we've always maintained balance. But then we get this hugely corrupting influence that invades our presence. And suddenly Jeffries is in a state of panic, like we see in Fire Walk With Me. You know, he's going between South America and the FBI headquarters, I think, in the missing pieces. He's frantically trying to convey to Gordon Cole that this is not who they think it is, you know, and then he just disappears. So he's lost his ability to impact his environment at that point in Fire Walk With Me. And I would argue becomes something completely different. And so Mr. C, basically as Cooper's double combined with this hugely corrupting influence of Bob, is easily able to topple over and think two, three steps ahead of what is a normal function to bring balance back, which I think is the alarm that calls the firemen in. But we'll talk about that in a moment as well.
Well, so, I mean, this gets to, you know, back to the point of how much of Philip Jeffries, the quote-unquote real character that we likely saw in Fire Walk With Me, is active in The Return. And, or season three, if you want to call it season three. I mean, I think there's something to the fact that Philip Jeffries, as Gordon Cole says, doesn't really exist anymore. He, something may have happened to him. It may be, as you say, it may be he just got overwhelmed by whatever evil forces were unleashed, and he retreated into this, you know, untethered realm of timelessness, and no longer even, you know, has a body or a human form anymore. We don't know why that occurred, why Philip Jeffries transformed into this other entity that's this big, you know, kettle, I guess people like to call it the kettle, which was not Lynch's intent. But, you know, we don't, obviously we know outside the narrative it was because, as Frost says in the book, you know, David Bowie was no longer available, so they had to kind of have a workaround. And Lynch added in this ambiguity and this whole, you know, abstraction to Philip Jeffries. But still, it begs the question as to why did Philip Jeffries end up that way?
Well, why did the arm end up that way?
Why did the arm end up? And again, it's the same reason outside of the narrative, because the actor was not available. Michael J. Anderson was not available to reprise his role. So they transformed him into a tree. So why not?
I like the idea of it like being a metaphysical arms race where, you know, the stakes are getting so high that these agencies have to morph and evolve into other types of being, right?
Well, you know, and you wonder if it's an effort to achieve something or if it's an effort at retreat, and whether or not they're just moving away and saying, you know, I give up. I'm not sure I want to get that specific. I think with Philip Jeffries, I like the idea that maybe Philip Jeffries no longer was bothered with the mundaneness of the FBI and the Blue Rose cases, and he'd been so exposed to whatever these otherworldly forces are that he just sort of drifted off into another realm, which to him was more significant or more important or something more engaging than this this earthly realm and all of the violence and the dark age and all of that. Philip Jeffries just, he drifted away from it. And because of that, I think it's unlikely, if that is who Jeffries has become, I don't think he's going to meddle in the affairs of man. I don't think he cares that much whether or not Mr. C is stopped or whether or not Bob is put back. That Jeffries is kind of, he's just sort of let go. And so someone else is assuming the identity of Jeffries because it's used, that identity is useful for them to fool Mr. C and to fool Albert. And that entity is more in tune with being able to manipulate the forces of the real world. And again, I think it's Mike.
Yeah, I love this. And it's not too far off from what we get in some Greek mythology. I mean, we have gods that assume the forms of animals and men to confound mortals, and mostly just to sleep with women, it feels like, if you look back at the Greek god myths. But it's very similar in concept here. So I don't think this is anything like earth-shattering.
No, and it's great that you bring that up, because I think the Philip Jeffries of Fire Walk With Me, and arguably this is the Philip Jeffries before he drifted off into whatever realm he's in, I think there a good case can be made that he took on the form of an animal, that he was the monkey that that shows up in the meeting at the convenience store. He says, I've been to one of their meetings, and we see the monkey peek from behind the mask. And then, of course, Philip Jeffries talks about Judy, and it is the monkey later in the film who says the word Judy. And so, there's enough there to kind of equate the two, that Philip Jeffries took the form of a monkey, and that's who Philip Jeffries is.
And the mask, I think, in Fire Walk With Me connects the monkey to the little boy, to the jumping man. And then as Philip Jeffries is screaming, we see the jumping man. So I think it's very clear, just visually on the screen, that all of those characters are connected together. That's my impression.
Yeah. And, you could almost make an argument that these are the various versions almost that Jeffries is kind of transforming through on his path toward this kettle. Which I don't like to use that term, but everyone knows what I'm talking about when I say it. So
I think the machine is the official
the machine, the clanging machine. Yeah. So it's as if Jeffries is kind of losing control of his corporeal form in these moments as he sort of shifts through various shapes toward something non-organic or non-earthly.
So, just as a reference, in Game of Thrones, there's that whole story about the faces, the gallery, where they can put different faces on.
Uh-huh.
So that concept of, do you lose your identity if you can put on too many faces, which is what I think Arya struggled with in Game of Thrones. Maybe Philip Jeffries put on one too many faces throughout what we see, right?
That's a great point, because there is a lot in Twin Peaks where we see characters who may or may not be who they think they are, or they've retreated into a different personality, perhaps, and so they begin to question their identity. I mean, so much about Twin Peaks overall, and especially The Return, is about identity and figuring out who you are, and coming to peace, perhaps, with who you are. Even the general, quote unquote, general characters like. I should say the non-supernatural characters like James, still he's trying to figure out who he is. Who am I? He's still stuck in 1989. So anyway, yeah, that obviously that whole identity thing fits on Jeffries as well.
Thank you.
Perhaps it's wise for us to move into the meat of this, which are the two primary conversations where we hear Jeffries talk. You know, in on the camera, we see whatever's supposed to be Jeffries and we hear it talk. So,
yeah. So, you know, what's striking to me is that we have these two encounters with what we assume is the real Philip Jeffries. And I've got it. I'm going to say up front here that this really gets very tough to get your hands around. And I don't really have an answer. I can't say, you know, that I figured it out at all. Jeffries is that kind of character, and I'm not sure you're supposed to be able to figure him out. I think he is supposed to be elusive and very, very difficult to fit into the story. But that being said, we do have these two encounters. One has Mr. C going through various corridors through the Dutchman's to finally get a meeting with Philip Jeffries, and he has a lot of questions. And so there's this dialogue that goes on between the two of them. We'll talk about that in just a second. There's a second version, very similar, where Cooper in part 17 is sort of guided through these various corridors by Philip Gerard or perhaps Mike to another audience with what, again, we assume is Philip Jeffries. In that second version, Philip Jeffries says some nonsensical things or things that don't seem to fit with the conversation. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. In that second conversation, he says things like, "Did you ask me this?" And there may be someone. I mean, these are non sequiturs. They don't fit with the back and forth dialogue that we, you know, assume would be happening between Cooper and Jeffries. He also says something very, very curious to Cooper. He says, "This is where you'll find Judy." And I mean, that's open to all kinds of interpretations. What is he talking about there? "This is where you'll find Judy." I mean, Cooper's asking to go back to 1989. Is that where, you know, Cooper's going to find Judy? Or Jeffries has just mentioned something called the unofficial version. Is that where Cooper's going to find Judy? And why is he bringing Judy up? Because Cooper hasn't even mentioned it. And so it struck me that some of what Jeffries is saying in that second conversation seems to fit a little more logically with the first conversation that he's having with Mr. C, as if this Jeffries entity is experiencing both conversations at the same time.
And so, friends, what you're about to hear is a recalibration of those two conversations into one that's a little more coherent. We're not saying this is the definitive version of it, but it's something that John and I went back and forth on and what made the most sense. So take a listen. This is really fascinating.
"Why did you send Ray to kill me?"
"What? I called Ray."
"So you did send him. Did you call me 5 days ago?"
"I don't have your number."
"So it was someone else who called me."
"There may be someone. Did you ask me this? We used to talk."
"Yes, we did."
"Please, be specific."
"1989. You showed up at FBI headquarters in Philadelphia and said you'd met Judy."
"So, you are Cooper."
"Philip, why didn't you want to talk about Judy? Who is Judy? Does Judy want something from me?"
"Why don't you ask Judy yourself? Let me write it down for you. This is where you'll find Judy."
"Who is Judy?"
"Did you ask me this? You've already met
Do you mean I've met Judy? Philip?
Oh, it's you. Thank God.
The date, February 23rd, 1989.
I'll find it for you. It's slippery in here. It's good to see you again, Cooper. Say hello to Gordon if you see him. He'll remember the unofficial version.
One particular instance is quite striking where Jeffrey says, why don't you ask Judy yourself? Mr. C is saying, you know, why won't you talk about Judy? And then Jeffrey says, why don't you ask Judy yourself? Let me write it down for you. And then the numbers come out. And then what seems to be a line of dialogue that would fit perfectly there is, this is where you'll find Judy. And he's giving him coordinates and he says, this is where you'll find Judy. So, as if that line of dialogue that's being spoken to Cooper later in the story fits, you know, more logically in this first conversation. And again, I would argue if that's the case, then Jeffries is so untethered. He doesn't really even know who he's talking to. He's trying to figure it out. He thinks maybe he thinks it's Cooper. Maybe he doesn't. He's confused too. But then he would be confused, I guess, about just about anything. And so, anyway, that I think that might help explain a little bit of why Jeffries behaves the way he does in these two very confusing and difficult conversations that take place between essentially two Coopers and Jeffries.
I'd also like to throw in the Fire Walk With Me conversation too, because I think it's important. I think whatever the level of understanding that Jeffries has about the moment he's in Fire Walk With Me, I think it's deteriorated significantly by the time that we see that first conversation with Mr. C. So that ability to even call out who do you think this is? Like, you know, that presumes that he's got a knowledge of who it really is. But at this point, they're questioning each other, like, you know, are you Jeffries? Are you Cooper? And I really like this idea of Philip Jeffries as an agency having, you know, two or three conversations at the same time. That would be, you know, to him all happening consecutively, but to us, it's actually happening in the beginning, the middle, and the end of a story, right?
Yeah. I think that you, and I think Frost talks about this. I actually think he talks about it in the final dossier where he has Tammy essentially trying to figure out, you know, what Jeffries is. And she knows about this original meeting that happened with Jeffries in 19, well, we can get into why the dates are wrong, 1989. The movie establishes it as 1988. The return says it's 1989. I don't really want to get into that. It's a mistake and it's not a mistake. And well, I think you and I talked about that, you know, it doesn't matter, right? Because time is so slippery that you can excuse it away as Jeffrey's just not even knowing, you know, what's going on in time. So, but yeah, he seems to be perhaps experiencing these various things as he's untethered to time, experiencing these various encounters simultaneously. And you just brought up something really interesting. I really kind of thought, you know, formulated, but the idea that Mr. C is approaching Jeffries, and he's not sure really if there's a real Jeffries or an imposter Jeffries. He's trying to get his ground under him, and the same thing is happening with Jeffries. He's looking at Cooper and he's like, are you Cooper? So you are. So neither one of them is sure of the other's identity, and that's an interesting parallel that I hadn't really considered before, but you know, it's definitely there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing we can assume is correct is that whatever this machine is that we meet, it has some type of control over memories, or at least the perception of reality, because it alters it. You know, it allows Cooper to go back and alter what is essentially, you know, a concrete post, support post of whatever this experience is that he's going through. That Laura Palmer was murdered, she died, I came to Twin Peaks, I helped solve it. Like, pulling her out of that and saving her just makes the whole building collapse. And Jeffries perhaps is like, that's the last thing that agency can even do, is allow Cooper to manipulate his own concept of reality.
Yeah, and so this is where I get at, and I think you and I are kind of on the same page here, is that I said earlier in the podcast that I thought that if there is a real Jeffries in the story, he only appeared once, and that one time is the conversation with Mr. C in the Dutchman's, and that the second conversation is Cooper, I don't want to get, I think neither of us wants to get too deep into our theories of our overall approach to the story of Twin Peaks, the return, but we do have to kind of at least throw out our basis here, which is so much of what happens in part 17 and arguably parts of part 16 are subjective and overly more subjective than any other perhaps part of the earlier narrative. There really is an exaggerated quality to it. It seems as if it's Cooper's wishful thinking that sort of imposed itself on the story. He sort of inserted himself in, and he wants it to go this way. There's lots of reasons we can talk about why and how it makes some sense. I'm not going to get into that. Let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that what's happening in 16 and 17 is really a lot of Cooper's imagination. And so if that's the case, Cooper wants to go back and save Laura Palmer, and he's trying to figure out how he can do it. And so he kind of assembles the pieces of the story that have happened so far. Oh, there's a door in the Great Northern with a funny sound, and I have a key over here, and I'm going to open it up, and I'm going to go meet Philip Jeffries, who Mr. C met. And I want to do that too, and I'm going to get him to open the door for me to go to 1989. If anyone can do it, Philip Jeffries can. And so you get the sense, well, I do, and I know there's a lot of people who would probably push back with different theories, and that's absolutely fine. But I get the sense that this encounter that Cooper has with Jeffries is an idealized, exaggerated, imaginative encounter where Cooper is getting from Jeffries what he wants to hear. And you and I talked about this. One of the things that Jeffrey says to Cooper is, say hello to Gordon if you see him. He'll remember the unofficial version. And the unofficial version is such a confusing term, and it's open to so many interpretations. And, you know, I guess on the surface, it's, well, there's a version where Laura died and there's a version where she didn't. One's official and one's unofficial, perhaps. Or perhaps it's just Cooper's subconscious giving himself permission to go do this crazy thing where he thinks he can go save Laura, where Gordon is going to remember the unofficial version. This is your permission. Gordon's going to be there. He's going to know what really went down. Go ahead. Go try to mess with time. And Cooper feels a sense of permission from Philip Jeffries. And so I know this is a bit of a stretch, and I know, you know, I'm asking people to swallow a lot of, you know, possibilities here. But my comfort level here is that that this Jeffries that Cooper is encountering is part memory, part imagination, part, you know, he's reassembling the Jeffries encounter that Mr. C had, which is why some of those lines of dialogue, like "This is where you'll find Judy," or "Did you ask me this?" are bubbling up in this conversation, because they really occurred in that encounter with Mr. C had. Now, again, I know that sort of conflicts with the idea of the simultaneous, Jeffrey's conversations, but I think you can kind of allow both of them to fold over one another. I would argue that there really is a Jeffries, and that Jeffries is appears to Mr. C. But I would certainly argue, given what we've seen in Fire Walk With Me and these other, that he's untethered to time, that things are happening simultaneously with him. And Cooper's mind is overlapping with so many different realities at this point that you can make all of that kind of very, very, generally fit together. But my comfort level is that Cooper is encountering the Philip Jeffries he wants to encounter. And Jeffries being Jeffries, whatever he is, could certainly be making contact with Cooper on a mental plane, and that there is some exchange going on there. But Jeffries is such an ambiguous character. You can have it always and still walk away from it. So anyway, I just threw a lot of stuff at you, Josh. I haven't let you comment. So I
want to talk about the growing hum that we hear Ben Horn and his secretary following the hum. We hear the hum in the room in part 16 when Cooper wakes up. So that's what draws Bushnell Mullins out of the room, is to follow that hum. So back to the point of this sleeper who is slowly starting to allow the goodness inside of them to build and build and tone. And that's what I would argue the hum represents, to the point where they actually become like a vivid dreamer, where they realize they're dreaming. They kind of have some influence, but not direct action influence. And, you know, the green glove and all of that stuff is very comic bookish, as is the little infinity symbol that unlocks and the little thing moves around the bottom of it. And so I agree. And I don't think it detracts from both of those conversations happening at the same time, because ultimately it's a story of complete awakening. And at this point, we're not completely awoken, because the dark side is still separate from the force of goodness within you. That has to be resynthesized. And so I feel like what we get in part 17, I would argue, is the real Philip Jeffries, because that's how it's supposed to work, where, that what's best inside of you actually works with the mechanism of your memories and your imagination within your dreams to bring balance in and send the man down to Columbia to capture the darkness that's loose in your dream, you know? And so I love that we disagree on this. I think it's phenomenal, because both sides are true at the same time. Yeah, maybe both of those are Philip Jeffries.
So when you say it's the quote unquote real Jeffries that Cooper might be encountering in part 17, do you mean like literally it is the real Jeffries, as an individual autonomous being, or is it more of what Cooper would want the real Jeffries to be? There's a distinction there.
Yeah, I think it's more what Cooper expects of whatever the agency that Philip Jeffries represents. It's more of what he expects to work with him inside of this dream and in his life, right?
So you would assign then, it's essentially that the identity of Jeffries as an aspect of Cooper's deeper mind. See, it's funny, because I'm doing the same thing. I'm saying that this Cooper, but we're different. I mean, I would say that that there really is, though. I mean, I guess I would argue, we can get into this on another podcast, but that there is an autonomous being called Philip Jeffries, that he's not entirely an aspect of Cooper, that he exists, and that Mr. C encounters him, but the one that Cooper sees is filtered certainly through what Cooper wants to see. So yeah,
Same with Major Briggs, by the way. You know, nobody really thinks, I don't think, that Major Briggs is a real floating head in disincorporated space, right? But it's a memory that has been manipulated to represent something inside of Cooper's experience, right? So yeah, 100%. There could be a Philip Jeffries, an agent that was recruited by Cole, and all that actually happened. But what we see is how it impacts Cooper as he's struggling to come out of this, I think.
Yeah, I think you and I are very much on the same page, but I do think it's funny. We are sort of looking at the same page, but we're looking at it from different angles.
And it's so there a two-way mirror.
There's a difference. It really is. Let's not get into all of that, unwrap all that right now, but suffice to say that we have similar takes, and yet we're also coming at it from different.
And I love that about Twin Peaks. I do. I love that about Twin Peaks.
So the thing that we kind of can't ignore is the Owl Cave Ring. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that and why the movement of the Owl Cave Ring through the story seems to support the idea that it's Mike and not Gerard who is doing it. And so just a quick rundown, and then, you know, we can explore it or we can just let it go. Doesn't matter to me, but it's curious to me that this ring, the first time we see it is on the real Dougie Jones in Rancho Rosa. He transports it to the Red Room where, ostensibly it's Philip Gerard who takes it and puts it on the pedestal. The pedestal from Fire Walk With Me, which seems to be the home of the ring in the Red Room. That's where it belongs. That's the place where it goes. The next time the ring appears in the story, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going to try to do this all from memory without my notes. The next time the ring appears is Ray has it in his pocket. And he says to Mr. C, as he's laying there, you know, he's been shot by Mr. C at the farm, he says, I got it from a guard. A guard gave it to me before I was released from the cell at the Yankton prison. And so the question is, how did the ring find its way from the Red Room to Ray? Obviously, if we want to, you know, say it, that it's an actual physical object, it's moving through some sort of, you know, chronological path, which it's Twin Peaks, so it might not be. There may be five rings and they all, you know, blink in and out of existence. Who knows? But let's just assume that we can at least say that there is some chronological path. So who gave it to Ray? Well, whoever it was said to Ray, I want you to put this on the finger, you know, once you shoot him, once he's dead. So, I mean, again, that's the idea of we want to get him back into the Red Room. We want to be with Bob again. So I would argue that it's Mike who did that. Mike inhabited the physical aspect of Philip Gerard in the Red Room and took the ring and moved it back out into the real world, and Ray has it. And then the ring ends up back in the Red Room once Ray goes to the Red Room. And I think Gerard takes it and puts it on the pedestal again. And then Gerard gives it to Cooper, if I'm not mistaken, in part 16. So again, that's another story and another thing. I argue that maybe that ring, maybe the ring is, you know, Cooper needed the ring because he's assembling all the pieces of the story, what he needs. So he needs a ring and he gets a ring. He's sort of imagining that. But let's put that aside. That's where the ring goes. And then the ring, I guess, gets put on Mr. C, and Mr. C, and this is all essentially metaphorical, is the whole idea of Mr. C being returned to the Red Room and the reuniting sides of Cooper and Cooper reestablishing a wholeness to himself. And so the ring at that point is out of the story, right? That's it. It's the last appearance of the ring is on Mr. C, and ostensibly when he shows up in the Red Room in part 18, right?
And I think that scene in 16 that you're talking about, it lends credence to this becoming more of a fantastical imagination experience, because he actually passes a physical object both, yes, in the golden seed as well as his hair,
right?
As well as, you know, as, yeah, actually I don't think he passes the seed, but he does take his hair and
takes the hair, just make another, right? And then, right, the ring,
so they're able to exchange.
Yeah, now obviously, well, obviously, again, it's Twin Peaks, nothing's obvious, but the ring did move from the Red Room back into the real world because Ray got it. So somehow it had to, you know, move in and out of this. From what little we know of the ring, it seems as if the ring has to be transported out or in by someone who's wearing it. And so if you go back to whatever the mechanics are that we see in Fire Walk With Me, it's Annie Blackburn who this is in the missing pieces, so it's outside the main narrative. I realize that therefore it has, you know, it can't be considered absolute to the narrative, but I think Lynch sees the missing pieces as being, you know, essentially part of, as he does Between Two Worlds, where he, Lynch, interviews Sarah Palmer and Leland Palmer and Laura Palmer. I think he might say that that's in continuity, but the ring comes out and the nurse takes it. This, again, this is a deleted scene, but it's available to anyone who gets the home video version. And so the nurse has the ring, and that's how it came out of the Red Room. And so if we want to track back, you know, and fill in a gap, we could make the argument. We know that the evil Cooper, once he, you know, came out of the Red Room at the end of the original series, we know from the return, it's established that he went to the hospital that night and obviously went in to Audrey Horne's room. But so that places Mr. C at the hospital the same night Annie Blackburn would have been there, the same night the ring would have been, you know, suddenly in the real world. And I would, you know, just for the sake of trying to, you know, dot all the I's and button the whole thing up, that Mr. C obtained the ring that night from the nurse. And he had the ring in his possession. And it was from him that's how Dougie has the ring, Dougie Jones, who was probably manufactured. That's why he had the ring on in Rancho Rosa. So I'm just filling in some backstory there, and maybe I'm being way too nerdy and obsessive and, you know, Star Trek-y about Twin Peaks, but these are the things I think about.
Well, that's what makes our podcast work, because this is a place for nerdy and obsessive people to come and really think deeper about these things, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm trying to fit some logical sense to it, and at the same time, I'm also trying to make the argument that, you know, maybe it's all subjective and it's all happening, or a great portion of it is happening as someone is imagining it to happen. So, you know, the ring could certainly be considered metaphorical, and we don't want to take it literally. That the ring it represents some deeper aspect of the psychological state of various people who feel trapped, and a ring binds them, as you know, Tolkien would say in Lord of the Rings, the idea of binding. A ring has that aspect to it. So I certainly, as much as I get into the nitty gritty of trying to make sense of the narrative, I also embrace the idea of the metaphorical aspects and what one object might represent outside of its just physical manifestation.
Right. When if I'm thinking of the first time we actually see the ring in Fire Walk With Me, it's the with this ring, Ivy Wed. Right. That's the scene with Philip Jeffries, by the way, where they're looking into. And so it kind of establishes it as a binding factor.
Exactly. Absolutely. With this ring, I thee wed. And the implication there, of course, is that the little man somehow can impose the ring, which he tries to do to Laura in the dream. He's trying, and, you know, Cooper's like, don't take the ring. He's trying to, I think the little man is actually holding it up to Laura, right? He's holding it right out. And so the idea is that if you take that ring from the little man, you're marked as a victim. And then you're going to be killed, and then they're going to gather your pain and sorrow, and they're going to, you know, feed off of it. And then the ring, of course, will find its way back into the Red Room, where the little man will once again find a new victim. And so, you know, that complicates and confuses things. The ring is, how's it moving in and out? And again, does it really matter? We really need to define it. I don't know.
I guess what I like about it is we assume that the little man is representative of the arm that was cut off that Mike had to sever, because Mike is an agent with Bob, obviously went out, I think, and targeted people and just, you know, consumed their pain and suffering without remorse. Eventually, Mike the head, develops remorse, a better nature about it, and severs his connection with the arm. But the arm still operates. It still has function. It still has agency.
Right.
It's just found a way around not being attached to Mike, right?
Right, which is a – I mean, again, that's a great argument for the identity of the imposter being the arm. But from what we see of the arm as it's established in the return, it does not seem to be and again, I know the arm has a doppelganger, which – I mean, that just adds another layer of what? Confusion. And, you know, for a while there, I wondered if Jeffries had a doppelganger. If everyone has a doppelganger, then certainly Jeffries does.
Maybe so, more.
You know, is Jeffries' doppelganger at play here? And I was kind of comfortable with that for a while until, you know, Frost kind of explicitly said it was someone pretending to be Jeffries. And, you know, Frost, he's not totally giving it away there. It could still be the idea of a doppelganger, but you get the sense that Frost's approach to this was that this story that's happening in the margins and underneath, you know, this whole backstory of who's out to get whom, was worked out, and that there was some entity pretending to be Jeffries and putting in play all of these things, moving the ring to Ray, potentially contacting Albert to get him to do something for him, and you know, just in an effort to get Bob back.
You know, when Cooper tells Cole and Diane that they can't come with him, that he has to proceed down the hallway, and when he meets Philip Gerard, or who we assume is Philip Gerard, the way that the man speaks is totally normal at this point in time. He doesn't have the weird echo. He's not talking backwards or doing any of the weird stuff. When he speaks and does the whole poem, it's in a normal voice. And so I think that if we ever see Mike in the return, that's the moment that we actually see Mike in Between the Worlds.
You know, that's an excellent point. And I've got to go back and watch that again. And I haven't quite got that far, and as I've been, you know, working my way through earlier parts of the narrative, but you make a great point, and there's a piece of evidence there to really support that, and that is the Fire Walk With Me poem. That you know, he's credited, though. The problem is he's credited as Philip Gerard. Now, we can squeeze around that and say, well, okay, so what? You know, he's credited as Philip Gerard, but Philip Gerard and Mike are essentially the same thing. I mean, that arguably could be Mike. Again, we have to be careful because how much of it is happening in Cooper's mind. But of course, Cooper's mind is opened to contact with otherworldly beings. We know this. The dreams that Cooper has had in the past, in the original series, and potentially in Fire Walk With Me, he talks about dreams multiple times. He is likely in contact with forces that are otherworldly, and that is how they make contact with Cooper, is through dreaming. So even if it is a dream, we could say this is this autonomous entity known as Mike. And Mike says the poem, you know, through the darkness of futures past, the magician longs to see one chance out between two worlds, fire walk with me. And it's only Mike, I think, who's ever said that. I mean, I know Laura has said fire walk with me, and you know, and I know other characters have read it, you know, have seen the scrap of paper, but it's Mike who's established in the dream, in the original series. He says, his name is Bob. My name is Mike. His name is Bob. And Mike says that poem, which is sort of an enchantment that almost seems to unlock or open doors, or however you want to look. It's almost like a spell. But boy, that to me, that does seem to kind of put the final pin in it, that you know, maybe it was Mike all along who was pretending to be Jeffries. I mean, this is the character who's essentially bringing him to Jeffries. And so if it is really Jeffries, again, who knows? But so yeah, that, you know, you're right. It's Mike outside of the Red Room. It's this being outside. We've only seen Phil Gerard in the Red Room, basically kind of wandering his way around the Red Room, trying to make sense of his own. You know, he says something's wrong, and he's sort of somewhat out of his element in the Red Room. But this other version of the one-armed man, let's say, does seem to have a more confidence about him. And maybe I'm reading too much into that.
Well, so then they get into the room, and his face, you know, he's very, let's just call it unsure. You know, he's shaking his head. He's, you know, when Jeffrey's asked, did you ask me this? And he's just kind of like, he's the entity that says no. Cooper's just standing there like, what are you talking about? But he's like, no, we didn't ask you this.
Yeah, I'm definitely gonna go back and look at that, and I apologize to anyone who's listening for not having researched that a little more. But you make me more comfortable with the idea actually that my theory that it's Mike, works that it, because we do potentially encounter Mike there in part 17, visiting Cooper. That works for me.
Well, and I think also, I never really pieced this together, but we have both Phillips in the room at the same time with Cooper, Philip Jeffrey, right. Philip Gerard. And maybe what's happening there is a synthesis of those two aspects of the same agency beginning to work together again to help wake this person up, to save this person's soul, to resynthesize the darkness and the light between them so that we can wake up finally, right?
Yeah, no, it is interesting that – I mean, it's fascinating that it's Gerard, let's say Gerard, the one-armed man. I don't know what to call him. I'm going to say the one-armed man because it's generic, that he's the one who guides Cooper to Philip Jeffries. Also striking and worth considering is that when Mr. C is essentially escorted to Philip Jeffries in – part 14, I think it's 14 or 15. I can't remember which one it is. I'm sorry. He comes through the door and walks directly across the courtyard of the motel, you know, that's the real location is up there in Snoqualmie Falls. But he walks straight across the courtyard, and then the bosomy woman, being whatever that is, unlocks the door and lets him into that motel room. But when Cooper in part 17 is being escorted by the one-armed man, they don't walk directly across the courtyard. They turn to their right and go access Jeffrey's. And again, at this point, it's otherworldly. It doesn't matter, right? I mean, portals open and doors open, and you don't have to physically move across the same space necessarily to achieve the same location. I understand all that. And yet Lynch is kind of deliberate here. I don't think it's a mistake that Lynch has these two characters turn right. We know from having watched the earlier part that he walked across the courtyard, and so they don't. They turn right. And so whether that's supposed to represent some sort of mental detour, or whether it's supposed to be you're visiting a different entity than the entity that we saw in part 15, and this is just how we represent that. It's striking to me that it happens, and I don't think it was accidental. I think it was deliberate that they divert. And to me, that means that whatever Cooper is encountering is different than whatever Mr. C encountered.
Well, here's how I like to think about that. Now that you bring that up, the idea that your true nature should be able to walk freely amongst all of your memories and your dreams and your imaginations, whereas something that's alien, that's corruptive, is going to need to hack into it. And that's essentially what Mr. C does to get audience with Jeffries. He asks the woodsman to hack into it, and he pulls his little, you know, operator cords in and out, and they essentially hack it into the motel, and that allows Mr. C to take the path of darkness there. But there's still another barrier. He's got to go through that. I kind of look at that as a Beulah character. Maybe it's a doppelganger or Beulah, I don't know. But he's got to go, you know, essentially have an audience with that entity,
right,
that unlocks the door. Whereas Cooper and Gerard walk freely.
Right.
They walk a different path. They don't walk the path of darkness. They walk a different path to get there.
No, there's no doubt the two approaches to Jeffries are distinctly different, and they represent different mentalities, I guess, at play. And the other interesting thing, I think, just observation worth perhaps commenting on, is the way Jeffries treats Mr. C, it's almost as if he is, giving him an audience, a brief audience. And when Jeffries is tired of Mr. C, he just disappears. He's done with him. You know, he's given him all he's gonna deign to give him. And again, maybe I'm reading way too much into it, but it seems like Jeffries that Cooper encounters is a little more. He's a little more welcoming. He's a little more, like he's an ally versus perhaps an opponent in the first one. There's a subtle difference there. I just throwing it out there. I think it's worth noting.
I think it's absolutely worth noting. I think it resonates because, you know, Mr. C is essentially fails in his conversation with Jeffries. He's booted from the room. He never gets his question answered. He gets a false set of coordinates. You know, all the coordinates he gets are a trap, but this one certainly is. So we know that they're combative. Like he literally sent him to his death. So, you know, the other side of it is Cooper got what he wanted. He was able to hack into his perception of reality and change the past in his own mind.
Yes, which makes complete sense. If Cooper is kind of, you know, trying to manipulate the reality he wants to have happen, of course he's gonna, you know, somehow. I mean, it even for Twin Peaks it seems so extreme, unless of course you think of it in terms of the mental landscape, that he would go and say, I need to go to 1989. You know, get me to 1989. Well, okay. You know, it's just like 430. You know, why does Cooper assume that 430 is 430 miles? And in which direction? I mean, none of it, you know, it's all intuited and he knows exactly what it means, or it's just sort of a randomness. He says 1989, but he doesn't. I may be wrong here. You may have to cut some of this. He gives the exact date. Okay, he does say the date, February 23rd, 1989. But even so, by saying the date, I mean, that's 24 hours you can play with right there. And yet somehow, you know, Cooper appears exactly where Cooper knows he could intercept Laura on her own.
Yeah, and we had talked about this. That was the last safe moment she had before she was murdered, was that moment.
Yeah, and so... Right, she's walking through the woods, and he appears to her there, to intercept her, and so, you know, I mean, that that's Cooper, you know, thinking, okay, this is where I need to be, and again, maybe I'm asking too much of the story, but it there's an ambiguity there. He just says February 23rd, 1989, and of course he appears. Right in those moments where he can stop her from going to the cabin. My take on that is that Cooper is arriving where he wants to arrive, not necessarily where an entity called Philip Jeffries placed him.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and then what happens there is, you know, obviously Laura screams and disappears. She screams and disappears in part two. And then, and I think that happens simultaneously. I think those two moments are basically what allows, you know, Mr. C and Bob to subvert the dream and make Cooper non-existent. But they had to do that. They had to pull that pin out so that Cooper could eventually come to the point where he's searching for Carrie Page. Like it all has to happen. It just doesn't do it in a narrative, logical fashion.
Yes. And let's tease our listeners, if they've made it this far, to say that you and I have talked about the scream, and we have some theories about the scream and where and why it does what it does and where it might have originated. Let's leave that though for another another time. Yeah,
that's going to be a good conversation. But yeah, you're right. You're right. So I guess, you know, as we're starting to wrap up Philip Jeffries and how important we think that character is to the show, what's the best way in your mind to wrap up who you think Philip Jeffries is and what is his value to Twin Peaks: The Return?
Wow, that is a good question. I think, well, you know, again, we start at the beginning, what was written initially was intended for one thing and it became something else. That's the beauty of Twin Peaks, is that it changes, it evolves. Even when it's done, I think Twin Peaks evolves. Even, you know, it's obviously being, it evolves in the creative time of Lynch and Frost, you know, as they're developing new material from the pilot all the way through to the return. One idea transforms into something else. That's what happened with Philip Jeffries. I think even as a static, you know, final product, it still evolves. I know this sounds kind of new agey-ish, but the idea that we as viewers, we go to it and you know, I know if I watch The Return 10 years from now, I'll be at a different point in my life and I might very well see it completely differently than I do right now. And I think that's the beauty of it. And I think Philip Jeffries is kind of somewhat represents that he's something that constantly eludes the narrative. He's constantly shifting. I think Lynch and Frost too, from what you read in conversations with Mark Frost, is very comfortable with that idea that he doesn't quite have any, there's no way to really pin him down. I'm comfortable with sort of letting him go. I think he let himself go. I'm comfortable with just sort of sitting back. And even though we've devoted an hour and 20 minutes to trying to unwrap and define Philip Jeffries, in the end, he is one of those wonderful characters that that you know, has a different aspect to him or it whenever you look at him.
Yeah, I guess I like to put characters like this in terms of like Dungeons and Dragons, and I think he's chaotic good. You know, if you think about just what his disposition is, I think he's ultimately aligned to what's in the best interests of the organism, but he's completely dispassionate, almost a trickster kind of character. If he had a little more agency and form, I think it would be like a Hermes type trickster character that could have been a really interesting soul. Maybe someone like Albert, even, you know, has some manifestations of that as well. In fact, by the way, Albert gets a great zinger in on Jeffries in Firewalk with Me, where he puts his hand on his shoulder. He's like, "You take a bump to the noggin, did you, Jeff?"
Yeah, he suffered a few bumps to the old noggin there. Huh? Yeah.
So
I
love the Philip Jeffries character. And to your point earlier about, you know, embracing change and embracing circumstance, I feel like if the creators and writers of Twin Peaks have done anything, it's they've just leaned into it. Whatever's happened, they've kind of just leaned into it and let the gaps become the special places that people can pour their own thoughts and their own emotions into until it sits right.
Certainly that is so true of all of Twin Peaks, right? I mean. We interviewed Miguel Ferrer a long, long time ago for Wrapped in Plastic, and asked him about, you know, working on Firewalk with Me, and I'm going to get the quote wrong, but he relayed this anecdote. It's just really fascinating, where they're shooting the scenes with Philip Jeffries, and I think Lynch comes over to Ferrer, and he just kind of takes him aside, and he goes, "Look, that's David Bowie." So they were kind of in awe of this figure. So I just wanted to remind people of that.
Be specific. Now.